Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and I was supposed to have a week off this week, but some rat-licking idiot decided to visit my wonderful disease-free region while COVID positive, didn't he? And apparently this guy doesn't believe in COVID. Which is funny because he's now in hospital. Some people are saying he's in a coma. But before that, he spent 5 days in the community, unmasked, and didn't use QR code check-ins anywhere. So, we got locked down for a week. So I thought, hey, I might bump my week off to next week when I can actually, you know, go places. So that means the interview with HD Moore that I plan to publish today will go out next week instead. Sorry about the schedule change there, folks, but there's not much I can do about it. Anyway, we'll be checking in with Adam Boileau in just a moment to talk through the week's security news. We'll also be hearing from Alex Stamos in this week's news segment. Alex had an interesting week, which involved having a Twitter fight with Edward Snowden about Apple's child sex abuse material scanning initiative. But Alex will just be joining us to share some general thoughts on what Apple's done with all of that. And then after this week's news, we'll be hearing from Matt Cawthorn from Extra Hop Networks in this week's sponsor interview. And we'll be talking about ransomware hack and leak and about how ransomware crews are kind of losing a bit of credibility. You used to actually be able to trust them to unlock your systems or keep your data private when you paid them a ransom, and that is not so much the case anymore, credibility is important to them as well, right? So do stick around for that interview with Matt Cawthorn. He is, of course, from Extra Hop Networks, and that interview is coming up after this week's news segment with Adam Boileau from CyberCX, which starts now. And Adam, I just want to start off by looking at some comments made by the Deputy National Security Advisor, Anne Neuberger, in the United States, just after we finished off last week's show. In last week's show, we discussed that one of the ransomware crews had done an interview with a journalist for The Record, Recorded Future's news website. And Neuberger actually brought this up while she was making some comments at a sort of forum or symposium. And it was a little bit surprising to me, but she seemed to indicate that this interview was like a good sign because the ransomware crew had said that it wouldn't target critical infrastructure. What did you make of all of this?
It did seem like quite a strange spin on the situation to me. I mean, the interview that the Recorder Future did was pretty softball, right? It really kind of gave the Blackbatter crew, a great platform to kind of talk about themselves. And when we were talking about last week, he said, you know, it just sounds like every other tech company interview, and kind of normalized a little bit. And then to see it kind of held up as an example of our pressure on these groups is working because they say they're not going to attack pipelines, and the implied kind of, well, now you can continue to attack other things and that's just fine with us. That angle really did seem a little bit strange, especially given that we've seen this kind of escalating rhetoric from the US government about taking a hard line against ransomware crews. And then now this kind of, it seemed a little bit backpedally.
Well, yeah, and not only that, but it looked like Neuberger was keen to sort of distance the United States from earlier indications that it planned to roll offense on these guys, which I was very surprised to see. You know, the comments were along the lines of, well, you know, you got to worry about collateral damage, etc. And, you know, you and I both know that when you're doing sort of targeted attacks against, say, the top 50 individuals in that ecosystem, you don't really have to worry that much about collateral damage.
Yes, and the U.S. national security apparatus is pretty experienced, at using its cybers for quite targeted things. Like, they know how to do that, and they know how to keep the damage limited. I mean, you really have to look quite a long way to find examples of, Five Eyes operations, going too far, being spread too widely, going horribly wrong, having collateral damage. You don't see a lot of examples of that, whereas, of course, we do in slightly sloppier other countries' operations.
I can think of one good one, though, which was when someone applied an implant to a router, like a Syria router, like one of their core routers, and they hit reboot and it didn't come back. And that was pretty funny because we found out about that from the Snowden leaks, but at the time everyone thought it was Bashar al-Assad disconnecting Syria from the internet, but it was actually the Yanks. That was funny. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they probably keep their dirty laundry pretty secret as well. So I'm sure there's a bunch of listeners out there going, oh God, man, if I could tell you about this one time that we did this thing and oh, lordy, lordy. But you know, on the public record, a few less. But anyway, if anyone is capable of doing this stuff without collateral damage, it's probably the Americans. So,
And the idea that if these attacks just go against like SMEs, right, small to medium enterprises, that all of a sudden it's not a national security issue. I mean, that's a part that I don't buy as well, because ransomware at massive scale, even if it's just targeting the broad-based like SME ecosystem, that's still a national security issue.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen the level of impact that even small scale stuff, you know, small scale in terms of the organizations can cause, right? And, you know, the job of the government is to protect all of those people. It doesn't matter whether you're a pipeline or you're a, you know, convenience store, right? I mean, there's a bunch of
yeah, it doesn't matter impact, if you're a manufacturer, you know, of hose fittings, right? Like, you know, you disrupt all of the hose fitting companies and guess what? You don't have any more hose fittings. Like, everything is critical, right? And I think that's a discussion that we've had in our Slack a fair bit about how, you know, at a certain scale, everything becomes critical to the economy.
Yeah, exactly, yes. And, you know, the power of ransomware operators to be able to scale up their operations and to be able to, you know, distribute these targeting choices out to affiliates, and even, you know, central direction of these, you know, ransomware crews is still pretty flimsy, you know, even if the top level says, you know, we're not going to go after this stuff. As you say, you know, who knew that a hose fitting manufacturer was used by a critical pipeline, you know?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And look, Tom Uren, who is our editor of the weekly Seriously Risky Business newsletter, I think he had the best coverage on this. That, of course, appeared in our newsletter last Thursday. And you can find a link to that in this week's show notes. Moving on, and we've seen a little bit of leaking. I mean, this isn't as big a story as I guess some outlets have been making out, but someone leaked Conti, like the Conti ransomware crew's like internal manuals, like their internal tech documentation.
Yeah, someone popped up on one of the forums and posted this, you know, Russian tarball. Actually, it was a RAR file, I guess, which contained, you know, a bunch of their documentation things. The person in question had been working for the Conti crew as a, you know, quote, pen tester, unquote, i.e. people who are breaking in, doing the initial access, sorting out, you know, actually deploying the ransomware. And yeah, they were disgruntled at the amount that they were being paid and dumped some docs as revenge. And I hope their OPSEC is good. But yeah, the files are much what you'd expect, you know, how to use Cobalt Strike, how to, you know, do privilege escalation in Active Directory.
But I think this sort of ties into our discussion last week about how boring the interview with Black Matter was in most ways, in that how boring this documentation is.
Right? Yeah, like, I mean, exactly right. I mean, it's very workaday hacking, and, you know, it's the stuff that works. And, you know, certainly the sort of thing, like, you know, if we were interviewing people, you know, for a job here and they said, hey, I know how to do this and this and this. And, you know, if you knew everything that was in these docs, yeah, we'd probably hire you. That'd be a pretty good place to start. But it is pretty workaday, you know, workaday hacking. There's no magic in here. It's just getting the job done.
Catalin Kimpanu over there at The Record has a good write-up here on some research out of Group IB looking at the Prometheus traffic distribution system. This is a shady organization that will deliver you shells, basically.
Yeah, so I mean, this is, you know, it's a good example of the kind of niche specialization in the, you know, technical parts of the you know, hacker, ransomware, you know, that kind of cybercrime world. In this case, it's kind of like, you know, like CloudFront or Cloudflare, but for malware operators, where you can say, I've got these payloads, I want to deliver these to these browsers, I've got a bunch of, you know, pre-compromised web servers, and you plug that all into the control panel for this thing, and it goes out, deploys its own kind of agent on all these compromised boxes, web servers that you've got. And then when you go and do your, you know, spam campaign or whatever other your thing you're using to get victims in front of your content, your malicious, you know, payloads or whatever, then this network will handle figuring out which browsers they're coming from, distributing the traffic around, vectoring the end user to the right payload, watching out for security firms and scrapers and other, you know, kind of bot stuff. And yeah, basically doing the same thing that Cloudflare or, you know, CloudFront would do for legit traffic. So pretty smart niche.
Yeah, like a malware CDN.
Much exactly that, yes.
Yeah, browser aware CDN. The end for malware. Crazy. Brian Krebs has a great write-up here just looking at how the ransomware crews really do play that name game where they go away and then they rebrand and whatever, and it's just, you know, their way of muddying the waters and not trying to build brands that are too high profile, I guess. But I just thought it was interesting. You know, he's even got a couple of little charts in here and whatnot. It's a good write-up.
Yeah, it's a good explanation of, you know, both the kind of the crews themselves and the software that they use, but also some of the individuals involved. You know, obviously Krebs has got lots of backstory of doxing everybody involved. So yeah, he's got a, you know, few names to tie some of these stories together. But yeah, it's just a good kind of overview of the family tree of some of these groups, and it's a good reminder as well quite how much money some of these groups were making. You know, even 5, 6, 7, 10 years ago doing this, and yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of people you know, having good times on their yachts in the Black Sea as a result.
Yeah. Gigabyte, the Taiwanese motherboard manufacturer, they got ransomwared. Doesn't look like it's terribly serious, though.
Yeah, they've exfilled, you know, 100 gig or so of data from them and threatened to drop it unless they pay a ransom. They said that, you know, in terms of interruption, it's mostly just kind of back office systems rather than manufacturing. But there is some interesting kind of potential there. Like if, for example, the data included like key material for signing like BIOS updates, that kind of thing, or, you know, source code to BIOSes, that you could imagine there being some quite juicy stuff in there for onward supply chain or people who have kind of niche interests. So if it does get dropped, there may be some fallout that, you know, is maybe a little bit different than the average one.
You would hope they were using an HSM for that sort of stuff, but, you know, you might be hoping in vain, but maybe not. You'd just think that sort of stuff is pretty critical now, so surely.
Yeah, sure. I wish I shared your confidence. Yeah,
famous last words by Pat Gray on the Risky Business Podcast.
I mean, I've stolen a few HSM backups over the years, and I'm making scare quotes here, because you shouldn't be able to back up an HSM.
No, you should not.
Got one job. One job.
Now, I want to talk about this report from CNN. It's a little bit cagey in terms of how it's been sourced, but it, you know, when you scan it, it feels like it's probably mostly accurate. But the story says that the US intelligence community has somehow managed to obtain an awful lot of data from a certain virology institute in Wuhan.
Well, you know, when you think about what sort of things would an intelligence agency be doing in the year, you know, 2021, cruising around inside the Wuhan virology lab and nicking all their research data, does kind of seem like the sort of thing you would expect a national security apparatus to be doing.
I mean, the jokes that we were kicking around was like, you know, the only reason we're finding out about it now is because it took that long to download the data.
Yeah, because there's so many people up in there all exfilling the same thing. You know, yeah. At least they could cooperate with some, you know, 4th, 5th, 7th, 12th party collect or something, share it around, you know, run up some BitTorrent or something. So they don't have to all exfil the many terabytes of genetic data. But yes, the reporting says that they have, you know, obtained through means unknown a bunch of data, and that now they're going to have a rummage through and see if there's evidence for, you know, COVID being sourced from the Wuhan virology lab. And we've seen a bunch of back and forth about how crackpot that theory is. And I guess, you know, this is the process of finding out. But yeah, the list of, you know, biological scientists inside the US government who can also speak Mandarin's probably not a big list. So
that's the funny part in this story, right? Is they needed people with clearances who also spoke not only fluent Mandarin, but fluent like scientist Mandarin. And yeah. It's like, there's not many, as it turns out. I do sort of wonder to what end you really want to know if this thing came out of that virology institute. I mean, say it did. Okay, great. Then what?
Then what? Exactly. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Sometimes they are, you know, if you ask the question, what are you going to do with the answer? I mean, what exactly would we do?
Yeah.
As a world.
I don't get that. And I just sort of feel like it's dangerous information, you know? Because you can imagine that it's going to make everyone mad. It's going to make people mad outside of China because, you know, it would have turned out that the virus originated there, you know, through carelessness, right? So to make everyone mad, and it will make the Chinese go apoplectic because they don't like people saying that they did bad things. And, you know, I just really wonder if it's a good thing for the planet that we know. Like, just drop it.
I mean, it may be, you know, in like the harm reduction approach, maybe it would be better if we didn't answer that question. Yeah. Like,
but we're a curious bunch, aren't we? We're a curious bunch. We are.
So, and I mean, you know, I guess maybe they should air gap their data, perhaps better than they air gap the virus. I don't know.
Now, look, staying on all things China, this is a very funny story, actually. It looks like a Chinese APT crew were trying to false flag as Iran while attacking Israel, but the false flagging is so half-assed. It is actually hilarious. And their false flags are like using path names with like Iran in it and like spitting out errors in Farsi. And you just think, come on. And they're still using like their same C2 and like everything else is the same. But like, it's like the Groucho Marx disguise of false flagging. This is exactly. It's clown show, I mean, stuff.
Like literally, you know, C/users/Iran. Let's just put our files there, you know, when we're about to exfil.
And they'll all think it was Iran.
And then we're going to rah them up and ship them to a Chinese C2. Like, come on, you could do better. They did at least use like one Iranian like backdoor or hacker tool or something that got leaked on a forum one place. But yeah, all the rest of their tooling just, you know, like common garden, you know, Chinese APT. So yeah, little bit low effort there, guys. You can do better.
It's like sticking a Ferrari badge on a Nissan or something, you know, and painting it red. This will fool everyone. But it's like a UNC 215. That's Research Adamantium. Just a funny one. Now let's look at what's happening in Belarus, because this is, very interesting. Someone has obtained an awful lot of data from the Belarusian government. And, this is, you know, opponents of that regime are going to probably find this data quite useful, because it includes things like who works for the KGB.
Yeah, this story is really, really fascinating. And I mean, we think of all the things we've covered over the years, you know, where there's been use of, you know, cyber techniques in, you know, kind of in national interest and national conflicts. This one is super interesting. So this group called they call themselves the Cyber Partisans, claim to be Belarusian, opposition freedom people. They have stolen, I mean, it's not just, you know, data about people who work in government agencies. They've broken to a bunch of government agencies, have got things like security camera footage and like wiretapping audio files of conversations between, you know, people in the regime and dissidents and so on. They, you know, passport data, which is used internally inside Belarus for local travel as well as international, you know, of the entire country, and, you know, employment details, a whole bunch of stuff that is really geared up to de-anonymize the people who are, you know, just following orders inside that government and support their, you know, kind of fight against that regime. And they've said, you know, we're apolitical and we're just trying to, you know, kind of promote freedom and promote truth and remove the anonymity of some of the people doing stuff there. But it's just a... I'm trying to think of another example where we've seen this broad intrusion into government systems and that much data exfilled and then used in this manner. Like, this does seem like a pretty groundbreaking.
Yeah, I'm just stunned that it's not bigger news, right? Yes, got the last 10 years of emergency call history, apparently, which includes details of like regime supporters who were dobbing in people for wearing the opposition colors sort of thing, right? And the passport data includes people's employment status and like whether or not they work at like the security agencies and stuff. They've got details of like, you know, apartments and safe houses and stuff like that. It's just they've basically doxed the entire state security apparatus and its snitches. And you just think, geez, imagine this if this happened in East Germany in 1987, you know, what would that look like?
Yeah, I mean, it really is just a stunning, you know, piece of work. And the report is a little unclear whether it's been, you know, purely hacking, whether it's insiders, whether it's a combination of these things. The people behind the kind of Telegram and Twitter accounts that have been talking about it are saying they're keeping the data offline and, you know, trying to handle it with the sensitivity necessary. Of course, you know, people are skeptical about that. But, you know, in a country that's got such turmoil, the idea that this would be, you know, part insider, absolutely seems plausible.
Well,
it
could also be a foreign intelligence agency doing this to them, mate. And I don't know that would be that surprising.
Well, I mean, that of course is absolutely possible. And if it was, right, if this was an intelligence agency move, then it looks real polished, you know, hitting all of the things that would be relevant, getting really, you know, data that's very, very hard to argue against. Because when we see disinformation used, or we see, you know, information hacked and leaked as part of kind of a disinformation or information kind of manipulation campaign, you know, there's often a lot of faking and there's often a lot of skepticism. You read Thomas Ridd's book and you look at the, you know, so many examples of, you know, that data being challenged because of its origins. Here, where you're dumping, you know, stuff that's so easily verifiable, and you know, is difficult to fake in terms of, you know, audio logs and camera footage and photos and passports and identities, that really lends credibility to whatever other data you've got, which if it was an Intel agency is a very pro move. But like, you know, the funny thing is in the year 2021, this could absolutely just be activist kids.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. And you sort of wonder, right? So say you're one of the people who got doxxed, right? You're thinking probably at this point, look, you know, we've got a very firm grip on the country at the moment, but you must be wondering, you know, if the regime falls, what are going to be the consequences for me now that I've been doxxed, right?
Yes, exactly.
So
exactly.
I think, and the limited sort of commentary I've seen on this, basically people are saying this will make the rank and file of the state security apparatus very nervous. And I think that's the intention here. And good.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, absolutely right. I mean, they've got things like lists of all of the safe houses and properties used by the state security apparatus. They've got registrations of all the vehicles that they used, right? So at the very least, there's going to be a, you know, months of operational churn whilst all of that gets burnt down and replaced.
Yeah.
Or they're going to compromise operations. And there's lists of people who are, you know, foreign intelligence operatives like in the rest of the EU. Like, there's just so much here. And the idea that you could throw this many problems at your adversary all at once is, you know, masterclass in using information manipulation and this kind of thing. Like, if Rid's writing volume two of the book, this is going to be a whole very important chapter.
Yeah, couldn't have happened to a nicer bunch of people, eh? Now, we've got an interesting write-up here from CyberScoop. Tim Starks filed this one. Look, we had a similar piece up about a year ago written by Brett Winifred, which was looking at how a judge ruled that legal privilege didn't really apply to the incident response documentation that Capital One had prepared internally for its incident, right? So quite often, for those who don't know, quite often what happens is when a company gets breached, they will contract a law firm to contract incident responders so that the whole thing is covered under legal privilege, thus keeping the actual reports away from anyone trying to sue them. So as I say, last year we ran a story on risky.biz about how that was starting to crack, and it looks like really we're moving to a world where that legal privilege just won't be available to companies anymore, according to this piece at least.
Yeah, this piece says, I think, there's been another three examples of court cases in which judges have requested that data be handed over to the opposing party, despite the presence of, you know, kind of legal privilege arguments. And I think it's a good example of the situation where, you know, there's lots of things that we, you know, kind of don't really know until we've got concrete kind of case examples of it. And this idea that legal privilege would be a reasonable way to stop that coming out, you know, was, you know, always going to be tested, you know, in the real world, and it looks like, as you say, it's crumbling a little bit. And, you know, whether or not that has negative consequences, I mean, obviously, the, you know, the idea that you'd retain a mandate or whoever else through a law firm at great cost, you know, the ticket clipping, I imagine, is not small.
Yeah, I was about to say, at least, you know, good news, everyone, your IR is about to get a lot cheaper.
Yeah. So, I mean, the fact that they were willing to spend that money to do that already, you know, suggests there's a real motivation to, you know, not have the results of this stuff, you know, be easily and widely available. That desire is not going to go away. And if we remove this protection, then it implies to me that people are going to be less interested in doing good incident response, right?
Well, but that'll create problems elsewhere, is my feeling, right? Because if you're going to be subject to some sort of lawsuit around an incident and then they ask for your incident response report and you say, we don't have one, I don't think that's really going to put you in good standing in a legal proceeding. But, you know, we're not legal experts, but I guess what I'm getting at is, like, yeah, it's going to change things, but how it changes things, I think it is way too early to say.
Yeah, exactly right. And then, you know, there may be some negative outcomes. You know, there may also be a bunch of real positive ones. Like, if we do see more transparency in incident reporting, maybe we'll improve the quality of it overall, right? I mean,
yeah.
It could go either way. We don't know.
Indeed. Now, changing gears a bit. You know, and listeners would have heard me quite often talking about how Instagram's, like, account management, account recovery, et cetera, about how that is a bit of a trash fire. I think we talked about how they had changed their account recovery procedures just recently, like encouraging people to set up like 2FA and test out their recovery procedures. We got a report here from Joseph Cox over at Vice Motherboard about some service that will ban anyone from Instagram for you for $60.
Such entrepreneurship. Yeah, I think this... this particular service, basically they have a fleet of accounts, and then they'll, you know, when you give them a target, they'll make their account look exactly like the target's account, like to copy the picture, copy the bio, everything else, and then report the real person's account for impersonation of your now modified fake account. And apparently that's enough to trigger their whole Instagram ban process, and, you know, it's sufficiently easy that it only costs $60 to do. So
yeah. Yeah, that's it. Staying with Instagram, and they have also managed to shut down a fake likes factory. This is another one from Joe. And yeah, apparently they just sent a cease and desist and that was enough.
Well, that's good. I guess that gets the job done pretty quick. I think this one was like a browser extension that you could install, and I presume that would give you some benefits. But yeah, then it would just fake like things on behalf of the network, which, you know, pretty small scale business. Although the guy that ran that said he made $100,000 in 2020.
Better than a kick in the pants.
Yeah.
I want to change gear a second and look, a big topic of discussion on the old Twitters over the last few days has been, Apple is introducing client-side scanning for known child sex abuse material like images, etc. So basically what they're doing is if you want to put an image into iCloud, it will get scanned on your device first. Now, of course, this has resulted in some people getting their knickers in a twist, as we'd say, about this, saying that it's going to be backdoor surveillance, etc., etc. Indeed, Alex Stamos wound up getting into a Twitter fight with Edward Snowden about this. Certainly, I think Alex in that thread had the better arguments. I think Snowden is somehow suggesting that maybe people will manage to manipulate the child sex abuse material hash list and insert political, you know, hashes of political imagery or something. I don't know. It didn't really make much sense to me. But there have been some, you know, a lot of people criticizing this because essentially what it's doing is it's, you know, Apple showing that it's possible to introduce device-side scanning for certain material, right? So there has been a lot of criticism thrown at it. So I actually asked Alex Stamos to send us in some audio with his thoughts on what Apple has announced. And it turns out it's not just the CSAM scanning. There's actually a whole bunch of other stuff that they've announced. And here's Alex Stamos with his thoughts on all of that.
Apple announced two totally separate child safety protections as part of this. And I actually have a different opinion of each. The one I like much more is the protection that is now built into iMessage. So Apple has created nudity detection for any kind of nudity, not necessarily for child nudity, that can be activated on child accounts that are tied to a family iCloud account. And if a child is below 13, an adult will get a notification if they see a naked photo. If they're between 13 and 17, it will just be blocked, but without the adult being notified. I think this is actually a pretty good start. This is something that I would like to see other companies think about, which is what kind of mechanisms can we put in place to both help parents protect child accounts, but also that will prompt people to protect themselves. Now, where Apple has kind of fallen down on this is there is no reporting mechanism in iMessage. So if you get a death threat on iMessage, if somebody sends you some random hate speech, or if you're a child, an adult contacts you and asks you for your nude photos, while this thing might catch it if that adult sends a nude photo themselves, it never goes to Apple. There's no mechanism to report to law enforcement and the like. And so what I'd rather see in this case is Apple put together a full pipeline for allowing people to report all kinds of abusive content on iMessage and then roll out machine learning to support it. But like the overall privacy implications of that, I think are actually quite reasonable. The other side is more worrying. And I totally understand what Apple is trying to do here. I think it is extremely likely that this is a prelude to full encryption of iCloud photos and iCloud backups, which are right now not encrypted and are available to law enforcement under lawful process. And so in that context, I kind of understand what they're doing. I think some of the specific decisions they made, and especially the rollout, have really screwed things up. And they've screwed things up not just for the possibility of us having some kind of reasonable political conclusion here of how to balance trust and safety and end-to-end encryption, but this is actually now threatening the existing child safety scheme. And I think a couple of the problems here, one, Apple rolled this onto phones without announcing whether they're encrypting or not, so people don't understand what the privacy upside is. And there's nothing that actually prevents the signatures from being updated by Apple from stuff that comes from other groups than the United States National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which is the initial group that they're working with. And I think that because there isn't like a technological control here, there's no transparency mechanisms or and such, and they haven't allowed anybody to test a neural hash, there's not a good limiting principle of what situations client-side scanning should happen. And I'm really now nervous about bills in the United Kingdom, in India, in the EU, that were already going to pass and to have filtering requirements are now going to be updated to include client-side filtering requirements because Apple has basically advertised out to the world it's doable. So, you know, on its own, that they had some good math, but they tried to throw math at a complicated political problem. And in doing so, they really made a hash of everything without consulting with people and without working with the rest of the industry. And so what I think they need to stop on the movement of that side. I have suggestions to enhance the iMessage. I think they need to stop on the CSAM side, kind of regroup, have a big public discussion. And if they are that worried about iCloud photo libraries being shared with one another with lots of CSAM, which is probably a legitimate fear, then I think that feature should just not be end-to-end encrypted. I think it's a totally reasonable thing for them to encrypt iCloud backups, but say, if you're going to share photos, those shared photos are not going to be end-to-end encrypted, and we're going to do traditional photo DNA. And in doing so, they will be staying to the same line as all these other companies, and they will not be opening the door to client-side scanning being required, again, by the UK, India, and the EU as probably the first countries that would do so.
That was Alex Stamos there. And look, I'm not even sure that I entirely agree with Alex, but I am not the expert. He has certainly spent a lot more time on this than we have, though, you know, especially through his time at Facebook, where I believe he, you know, assisted on all sorts of horrible inquiries involving the abuse of children as CISO when he was there. But, you know, I just don't think you're ever going to find a balance that'll make everyone happy. Right, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, these things are real difficult. You know, there's the responsibility to society, there's the responsibility to the owners of the company, the shareholders, and everybody else. And then there's, you know, a lot of technical reality. And, you know, a lot of the arguments that I've seen have been, you know, well, in the end, you have to trust Apple not to abuse this. And it's like, well, we kind of have to trust them anyway. You know, like you bought their device, you're running their software. You're kind of like, if you're worried about Apple backdooring your stuff to do the bidding of somebody else, then it's, you know, this doesn't change that.
No, it doesn't. And I think that's something that gets missed. I mean, I kind of see what Alex is saying about how there's some political angles to this in that showing that, you know, client-side scanning is possible and stuff. But, you know, people already knew that. Legislators aren't that stupid, right? So I don't know that it's going to make possible a whole bunch of other stuff that was previously impossible. But, you know, I just wanted to get his voice onto the show to talk about this because, as I say, he is someone who spends a lot of time thinking about this. And it was pretty funny actually watching him argue with Edward Snowden about this. So I don't know. Were you watching that when it was happening?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, it was pretty savage.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, that was fun. I should link to that thread. So I'll try to get that into the show notes. Some late breaking news that just dropped before we started recording. Apple has dropped its intellectual property lawsuit against Corellium, which I think is fantastic news. Of course, the core of the case already got tossed some time ago, but the DMCA component was due to kick off in court in like a few days from now, and Apple has withdrawn. Apparently, there's a settlement, which I'm guessing means Corellium can't say anything about it. I'm guessing that was probably the agreement, is Corellium gets to keep selling its stuff if they are prepared to not say anything bad about Apple anymore.
Yes, I think that seems to be a reasonable conclusion given that they are still selling their stuff. So, you know, that must have been one of the terms of the settlement, and we don't really know the rest, but STFU seems like what you would expect from Apple.
I mean, I got to be honest, like, I, you know, listeners would know that, you know, as a journalist, you're supposed to be impartial, but hey, this is a commentary show. I can say what I want. And I was always kind of on Corellium's side with this one. And it was a real sort of David and Goliath thing. And even though I was on their side, I got to admit to being pretty stunned that they prevailed.
Yes. I mean, you know, Apple normally doesn't pull the guns out unless they're going to win, right? I mean, yeah, they're not really known for getting it super wrong in that respect. I mean, because it's embarrassing for them to have to go turn around and withdraw a case like this. So you expect them to think before they shot, but no, not this time.
Yeah. My guess is Discovery just didn't turn out the way they thought it would, you know? So you sort of wonder if they had the wrong end of the stick, you know? You just wonder where this came from.
Yeah, it does seem a little bit strange, and I'm sure there must be some backstory that, you know, maybe one day you'll get at a con over a cold beer or something, but yeah, for now, I guess everybody's going to STFU and Corellium will keep selling their stuff and life continues.
A whole bunch of trash home routers are currently getting owned, Adam.
Yeah, this is a Taiwanese vendor, Arcadian, that are sort of the white label provider for a lot of kind of house brand routers that you might get from your internet service provider. You know, these are a little bit retro in terms of their application of modern security thinking. So, yes, there's been reports that a number of these Arcadian devices, you know, in their ISP guises are being recruited into botnets and presumably used for, you know, all the sorts of things that you'd expect, denial of service and pivoting for Russians and all that kind of thing. You know, like many consumer premises routers, actually getting these things updated is difficult. And it's quite similar to the Android ecosystem, you know, when you've got all these ISPs involved in customizing the devices and custom firmware and actually getting stuff like this patched in the real world is difficult. And unfortunately, one of the costs of, you know, one of the hidden costs of this kind of, you know, low-cost CPE.
Now, Catalan at the Record reports that Microsoft is shipping what it calls a super-duper secure mode for Edge, which actually does look, you know, reasonably super-duper secure, right? They're disabling the just-in-time, like, compiler. They're disabling the JIT compiler in Edge in this mode, and they're also, like, running, like, Control Flow Guard or whatever the hell they call it. So it actually looks pretty good. I'd like to use this, please.
It's funny because I saw the headlines go past on Twitter and stuff, and I thought, oh God, you know, yet another, let's bolt some more, you know, cruft onto the code base to try and make it more secure, you know, curmudgeonly whinge. And then I read the actual story, and yes, it's like, let's just turn off a bunch of the complexity where all the bugs happen and make it better. It's like, actually, yes, that's an excellent idea. They said something like, what, 45% of bugs in the V8 JavaScript engine in 2019 were from the JIT. And using the JIT means you can't use a bunch of the other exploit mitigation techs that you mentioned. So yeah, this is just a total smart move. And computers are just fast enough now that we don't need a JIT like we're IE6 in, you know, in 2003 or whatever. So yeah,
No, it's interesting because they did a bunch of tests and they're like, oh, it doesn't really slow stuff down. So yeah, when they disable the JIT, they can enable control flow enforcement technology. That's what they call it in Microsoft land. And they got another thing called arbitrary code guard. Not even sure what that is, but apparently it's, you know, it looks like a pretty good move. So let's see how Edge fares in super duper secure mode, because you know that for Black Hat 2022, someone wants to be the first to stand up their poppin' shells in super duper secure mode.
Yeah, exactly.
I reckon they named it that just to get the free audits.
Smart, real smart.
Real smart. And another one from Catalan here, and this is a super cool story, right? So there's this protocol called Apple Wireless Direct Link, and this is what makes things like AirDrop and whatnot work. And someone figured out a way to use it essentially as like a tunneling protocol, right, to hop between boxes. So, and of course, you know, they've written it up as like, oh, here's how you can hop an air gap. But anyone with a sensible air gap, they're not letting Apple devices into the SCIF, right? So I think that's a bit cheeky to say that this is a way to escape air-gapped networks. But the research itself is still very, very interesting. It's by someone called Mikko Kentala, I think. I've probably just completely botched the pronunciation.
Sorry, Finland.
He's the CEO of SensorFu. But yeah, what did you think of this?
It's really cool research. And I agree with your take that, you know, writing it up as air gap jumping, like we've seen all of the Israeli research about jumping out of air gaps with audio side channels and radio side channels and power side channels. So like that, you know, that angle of it, there's plenty of options that you've got if you're inside the SCIF and want to get out. It's the from the outside getting in that's the problem. But yeah, I mean, this was using like IPv6 over AWDL to then get out to exfil data. That's just really smart. I'm always a big fan of security research that involves IPv6 because it's such a, you know, unplumbed world of wonders and amazement every time you go and look at anything V6 enabled. So
I remember seeing Mark Dowd do a talk about IPv6 stuff. That was like 15 years ago, you know,
and it was so beautiful. That was one of my favorite con talks ever.
Said? Move like the fog through the forest or something, I think was the title, you know.
Yeah, that was good times. Just like telnet straight through an IPv6 firewall using Markdown technique. It was such beautiful, beautiful work.
Indeed. Microsoft has disabled, it hasn't disabled Windows Point and Print, but now you need admin rights to use it, which given that Point and Print can be used to install arbitrary system level drivers, seems like a sensible move.
It's the year 2021 and they've only just turned this off. Oh, it's always been such a mess. But yeah, it's good. At least we now have in the most recent patch this turned off by default, and you have to go turn it on in a registry key if you do want regular end users to run drivers as a system from remote printers. If that's a thing that you really wanted in your environment, then I guess you could turn that on. But yeah, this is good. Thank you, Microsoft, for just making this go away.
Yeah. Funnily enough, there was a pony. The NSA got a pony for its research into that that Microsoft core crypto flaw. I think that was last year. It was just so weird seeing the National Security Agency sending a tweet saying, yay, we got a pony.
Like, I know. Yeah. Oh, what a world.
Oh, it's great, though. I mean, you know, it's fun. It's fun. Now, what else have we got here? Cobalt Strike bug, which people have been, sort of sending funny tweets about and whatever. This is just a DOS bug, though, in Cobalt Strike, isn't it?
Yeah, this is a denial of service bug where you can kind of connect to the Cobalt Strike team server. That's the bit in the middle that all of the compromised systems connect to and basically kind of cause it to run out of memory. I think in this case by, you know, sending an arbitrarily large screenshot or something dumb like that. But of course, yeah, there's lots of blue teamers out there talking, presumably not doing, going around and blasting this to every team server they can spot on the internet and causing all of the people who use Cobalt Strike to no longer be able to use it, which, you know, given there's a lot of crime groups that use it, may not be the worst idea ever.
Yeah, and it's not their job to keep red teamers happy, so.
Yeah, exactly. I think Help Systems, who bought Cobalt Strike, you know, a couple of years back now, they have released a patch to the paying customers, so hopefully there'll be a little bit of a window before that heads off to the crime crews to use. But I'm sure everyone who's sitting on, you know, other bugs in Cobalt Strike better than DOS, you know, probably keeping those real quiet because you don't want to get them wrecked.
Now let's talk about this research out of Checkpoint that is it's a DEF CON talk. Basically, look, it's nothing particularly groundbreaking. It's basically just a heap overflow in an ebook, right, that you can use to pop a Kindle. Now, what I found, we're linking through to Tom Brewster's write-up on Forbes, but what I found interesting about this is it kind of misses, like, to me, what is to me the central point, yes, of this sort of attack, yeah, which is, yeah. So some listeners might not have heard of this issue. It's called the underpants problem. And the whole idea of the underpants problem is, say someone starts a business, you know, they're using Amazon infrastructure, the business becomes very big, and then they sell the business, they have to fork over the Amazon account. And Amazon doesn't really separate personal accounts from business accounts. Like, you just have an Amazon account. So the idea is, you know, that when you buy this company for $10 billion or whatever, you see the CEOs and founders, you know, purchase history, including their underpants, right, that they bought from Amazon. So there is every possibility that popping shell on someone's Kindle could get you EC2 infrastructure, right? Like, and I don't see it really written up in this piece, but that is, that's kind of a real risk here, isn't it?
I mean, there's certainly a lot of things that you could do with a compromised Kindle, and I think that is definitely the most interesting of it. I mean, the piece kind of writes it up as, oh, you know, we could create targeted attacks against political groups by writing political ebooks, and then, you know, we could target fandoms or something, and, you know, compromise all of the, you know, Star Wars fandom writers or whatever it is, you know, target attack being the, no, I think, you know, leveraging access to someone's Amazon account through their Kindle, and, you know,
that's the good
certainly
stuff.
That's certainly good with stuff. Really old infrastructure or things that, you know, don't have modern Amazon account management and things, which, you know, early in the startup life is not a thing that you do. I think that's a real smart use of it, so
Yeah, that was just the thing that sprung to mind, is I'm like, and I don't know if Amazon's doing a better job these days of tightening up that sort of auth, but yeah, like, it would be pretty funny if you could heap overflow through an ebook and then take over a whole company.
That would be a beautiful thing. I would, yes, definitely like that. I mean, Amazon account management is a lot better than it used to be now that they're encouraging people to segregate things, you know, using accounts as a boundary, but...
If you actually get the account, right?
Like all the way back in the beginning, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know.
Orange Sai was also talking to Vegas, and I'm going to say talking to Vegas because I don't know who was there and who wasn't actually physically there. You know, it's like this weird in-person hybrid Zoom COVID 2021 thing. But he was talking about Microsoft Exchange server bugs, of course, proxy logon, etc. What did we learn much new out of this talk?
I don't know that we know anything new that we hadn't already seen, but you know, there's a bunch of really interesting insights for people who are doing vuln research. And you know, Orange Sci has found so many great bugs over the last few years. And anytime you get someone who's had that experience giving some insight about how they think about things, how they approach it, you know, how they go through finding those kinds of bugs, that's really useful for everybody else. He also has opinions about, you know, how many more bugs there are to find in Exchange. Should certainly give pause to people who are still running Exchange on the internet. So, you know, when the guy that found this says, you know, there is plenty more in this place to be found, then you should probably be concerned and think about what you're going to do next time.
Indeed. And we got some more Vegas content here. Someone has published some research into Let's Encrypt. The team was led by Haya Schulman, who is the Director of Cybersecurity Analytics and Defenses at the Fraunhofer Institute for Secure Information Technology in Germany. That was a bit of a mouthful. but yeah, basically they're talking about how you can trick Let's Encrypt to issuing a valid cert to a server that is not, you know, where the domain actually is supposed to live. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Let's Encrypt is a super important part of our security plumbing these days. So anything that impacts Let's Encrypt is really important research. This was looking at the, like, a multi-party verification, a multi-path verification that Let's Encrypt will do where when you're verifying through DNS control of, you know, ownership of a domain, then they will go and query, you know, the domain key, the main thing that they're looking up from a number of different domain servers around the internet so as to get different perspectives towards the destination, so that someone who controls one network path shouldn't be able to
get a legit
fake
key.
This validation
get a
legit process, search, which, yeah. So this research was looking into, like, doing attacks to defeat that kind of multi-view verification process, which is really interesting, and they were able to issue fake certificates some percentage of the time, which is really, really good. But on the other hand, I don't know that there's any other CAs that do this kind of verification. So it's kind of like, you know, yes, this is an interesting bug, but every other CA was already worse than Let's Encrypt in this respect. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it is great research, but that is something to keep in mind, isn't it? Which is that Let's Encrypt is one of the better CAs. Like, and in terms of just, like, domain validated certs, like, they're it.
Yes, pretty much, right? I mean, these days, if you see a DV cert that, you know, isn't Let's Encrypt, it's kind of surprising.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we use them, but we got a write-up here from Lily Hay Newman looking at Natalie Silvanovich's work in messaging security, another Vegas piece here.
Yeah, this is some really cool research. Listeners may recall a while ago there was a bug in Apple's group video calling or group audio calling where you could get audio prior to the call being answered. So the FaceTime client would be sending audio before you'd picked up the call. And this was, at the time, a really, really interesting bug. And there was quite a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth about, you know, Apple not respecting people's privacy and bad engineering and so on. Anyway, Natalie went through and thought, well, this is a really interesting bug class, this kind of zero
wonder where
interaction.
Else it is.
I wonder where else, you know, same bug, different app. And she went and dug through a whole bunch of other messaging apps and basically found similar patterns of pre, you know, user interaction access through audio and in some cases video across a number of other platforms, including Signal, Google Duo, Facebook Messenger, and some other platforms as well. So really an interesting avenue of research and really does underline the importance, you know, of that kind of contract with the user that, you know, if you've got an app that can do audio and video, that it's only going to send it after you've explicitly told it to, and it's not going to go for performance reasons, because that seems to be the main reason this happens, is that doing call setup takes a few seconds. If you're Telegram, you're willing to wait a few seconds on call startup. If you're one of the other platforms, maybe you prioritize user experience, and so you set the call up in advance so that when the user hits answer, bang, it's already happening. So that kind of, you know, trade-off between engineering for performance and engineering for privacy, you know, it's certainly good to throw some light on that.
Yeah, now that was, of course, research done by Natalie Silvanovich, who is at Project Zero and is, you know, just an amazing researcher. And, you know, we're going to talk about some research from another weapon, which is James Kettle, who every year at Black Hat just drops something absolutely awesome. And this one, I just love this story because of the emotional journey I went through from headline to body, right? So the headline, and it's written up by Port Swigger, which is, funnily enough, like his news outlet.
Yes.
But yeah, the headline is HTTP 2 flaws expose organizations to fresh wave of request smuggling attacks. And the first thing I thought is, hang on, HTTP 2 is a binary protocol. So how would request smuggling actually like be a thing? And the answer is actually pretty simple and depressing and also kind of funny. Adam.
So the answer is a bunch of the HTTP2 front-end proxies you're talking to are just rewriting it to HTTP1 on the back end so they can continue to work with everything else without having to change anything. And this applies to things like Amazon's front-end HTTP proxies, which is not great. And so, yeah, James Kettle, as you said, total weapon at this kind of stuff, showed up, you know, with yet another round of I could have hacked the entire internet with my bugs, which, as I think it's been like every year for the last three or four. I mean, the year that we went, which is, I mean, that's what, 4 years ago now? I remember going to the James Kettle Black Hat talk, and it was I could have poisoned every Mozilla update in the world, you know, and backdoored everybody's Firefox. So, yeah, this guy is, you know, showed up once again with an internet ruining bug, which, you know, like Encapsula, the WAF that a whole bunch of people use, you know, big CDNs, obviously AWS's ALB is the biggest of the lot. But yeah, just savage.
Yeah, indeed. Look, we'll just touch on this one very quickly, but there was another talk in Vegas where some ex-NTSB person was talking about the proposed National Cybersecurity Safety Board, which is the NCSB. So it looks like the moves to create like an NTSB for cyber, which was one of the recommendations of the Solarium Commission, it looks like that's going to happen. And, you know, if they do it right, it has potential to be very worthwhile, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. I mean, we have so little visibility into what actually happens in the cybers. I mean, there's such, you know, opacity around, you know, who gets hacked and how they get hacked and what happens and who's doing it. And we're better than we were, but having, you know, kind of actual thorough government-led investigation, you know, can only help, I think. On the other hand, right, the success of the airline model, right, and the reduction in air crashes over the years from that kind of thing, you know, is a result of a bunch of things that are quite unique to that industry. Like,
well, yeah, I mean, I imagine the cyber equivalent, you know, it's like having an NTSB that has to deal with a plane crash every 10 minutes, you know.
Well, there's the volume problem, yes, absolutely. But, I mean, also the, you know, like having a central regulatory framework for planes in the ICAO and having, you know, no fault, like that culture of no fault analysis amongst, you know, pilots and air crew and investigators and airlines, like that's a really ingrained cultural thing for them. And we are, we have very much the opposite in the InfoSec world. And I struggle to see how effective it would be without that kind of cultural background. And long term, that of course would be ideal. You know, plus there's just a bunch of the ability to, you know, apply a bunch of leverage to airlines and how they behave and how they cooperate. And yeah, it is a different environment, but I do think it's a good idea, and I really would like to see something like this work.
Yeah, now we're running a little bit long this week, but of course that is because it was Vegas week last week, and we got another write up here of some Black Hat research. This into basically enumerating internal network information from DNS as a service platforms. This is cool, actually.
Yeah, this is really cool research. So this involves when you've got DNS zones hosted on third-party providers like Amazon or Google or whoever else, being able to kind of put records in their DNS that answers questions about the actual cloud provider's infrastructure so that you can kind of give a different answer to a client that's talking directly to those name servers already. And they were using it in this case to kind of catch dynamic DNS updates from Windows endpoints that were expecting to be talking to one particular place, and you end up being able to have them talk to somebody else. And from that, you can learn a bunch of, you know, information about the clients, you know, host names and where they're coming from. And the researchers have done quite a bit of work to try and make that a thing that is genuinely useful to get. I mean, I think the pattern here of poisoning cloud service things in a way that they don't expect to cause different answers, that overall pattern is a thing that is super important, and there's so many great examples of that kind of thing happening in cloud service providers, that kind of edge case. This one was less exciting for me than some of the other ones in this class, but this is a really fruitful area of research.
Now we got our skateboarding dogs, kind of, two of them this week. Newsmax and OANN, One America News Network, are being sued by the Dominion voting machine manufacturer. According to this report by Kevin Collier, they are seeking $1.6 billion in damages. So, yeah, the lawsuit party is continuing.
Yeah, the internal, you know, legal people at Dominion are really earning their keep at the moment. Like, they're just cranking out the billion-dollar lawsuits. So, you know, go for it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, they're alleging that these news networks were basically spreading misinformation that they knew was misinformation for profit, right? So I'm going to be real curious to, I mean, you'd guess that they will be settled. But if this turns into a big, messy public trial, God, it's going to be fun.
Yeah, it'll be most entertaining to watch unfurl because, yeah, you know, whilst I don't love, you know, electronic voting manufacturers, I certainly wouldn't mind seeing some other people in this case getting some comeuppance.
Now, we're going to end with just a Twitter thread, really, which is very, very funny. So I think, I don't even know if we mentioned it on the show, but the MyPillow guy in America, the big Trump supporter, was hosting a, you know, planned to host a cyber symposium where they were going to reveal PCAPs, and it's all just completely cuckoo, right? It's completely crazy pants. That's how cyber symposium is going on. Rob Graham actually went there. And this is like, Rob is a bit of a troll, right? And this is the most productive trolling I think I've ever seen. He basically just went there to troll them and to try to, you know, argue with them. And he's still tweeting. Like, I think, yeah, at last update, like there was a tweet like, you know, a couple of hours ago. But yeah, Rob Graham is there trolling the MyPillow guy and trying to get on stage to debate him. And it's quite funny.
It is good, but it's such a train wreck. Like almost, I feel myself getting stupider watching the thing unfurl. But yeah, I mean, if anyone's going to go show up and troll, like that guy does know how to, you know, wind people up and troll. And you know, he does know how to read a PCAP. So, you know, that part of it is 100% legit. But, oh, Lord, what a... It's just such a weird, weird world.
It is a weird world. But look, I'll link through to the thread. There's like, you know, 50 tweets in it or something. I just checked. I just refreshed it. The most recent one was like 50 minutes ago. It's just, it's gold. Like, it is actually gold. And I got to hand it to Rob. Like, I don't always agree with him on stuff, but this is good work.
It's some solid trolling. And I'm glad it's not me. Like, I don't want to go sit in that room with all the COVID deniers and PCAP fanciers. But there he is. So, you know, power to you, buddy.
I mean, he actually plonked down his own money to travel. You know? Like, and that is commitment. You got to give it to him.
Yeah, you got to hand it to
him. And it's, you know, I think someone else was commenting, oh, geez, you know, they're just waiting for someone to accuse Rob of being a liberal. Which is quite funny because, you know, from what I can tell from his public persona, that's not really where his politics are, you know. So the whole thing is just weird and hilarious. So, yeah, link in this week's show notes. But, Adam, that is it for this week's news. Now, with any luck, my region will be coming out of lockdown in a few days and I will actually get to have a week off next week. So we should be chatting again in 2 weeks. But who knows, man? It's all up in the air.
It is. It's a strange world. So, yeah, we'll see. Maybe we'll be back. Maybe we won't.
We're like our Schrodinger's podcast at the moment.
Yes, exactly.
That was Adam Boileau there from CyberCX with a check of the week security news headlines. Big thanks to him for that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Matt Cawthorne, the VP of Security for ExtraHop Networks. ExtraHop make a network monitoring technology that started life doing things like application performance monitoring, but eventually they just started adding more and more security functions to the product, and lo and behold, they're basically a security vendor now, and you can find them at extrahop.com. But Matt joined me to talk about ransomware crews doing the old double extortion. You pay once to unlock your data, and then you pay again to stop them leaking it. But the thing is, recent research has shown that paying to keep data confidential only works 70% of the time. And this is a problem for these crews. Well, it's going to be a problem anyway, because people used to pay because the crews had credibility. These days, with double encryption ransomware, where you pay once and then, oh, it's also encrypted again and you have to pay twice, and also with this hack and leak stuff, the crews are starting to lose that sort of sheen of credibility, and it's possible people will just stop paying. Now, data deletion on the other end is a crapshoot, even once you've coughed up the Bitcoin. So I started off by asking Matt why he thinks victims are still paying these data leak ransoms in the first place, and here's what he had to say.
I think some of it has to be for optics, especially if there's customer data or PII that's been out there, you know, even though the likelihood of it's getting increasingly unlikely that your data is going to, you know, they're actually going to hold up their end of the bargain, as it were. So when PII is involved, the company really has to show some sort of good faith effort. I think that that's pretty strong incentive for the customers, for the companies rather, to do something.
I think they're worried about the lawsuits around the disclosure of PII on customers and employees and things. Like, that's the only thing that I can think to explain it.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it, for sure. Definitely part of it. So it's, you know, it's interesting. And I think, though, with the new trend of that, it's all the rage now of the double extortion. You know, you exfiltrate first and then you encrypt and hold ransom, and they demonstrate that they've got your files off of your systems and into their world, or, you know, into whatever corners of the web that they, where they lurk, you know, that to me really, really decreases the likelihood of them holding up an honorable sort of deal on their side.
Yeah.
Once the data's out there, it's just out, I think.
The other thing I wonder about is, like, these crews might not be dumping this stuff, you know, onto the dark web for all and sundry after they get paid. But I find it hard to believe that they're not going to use the data some other way. You know, like, if you've got data that has some sort of value, you're going to hang on to that. This idea that you pay the money and they, you know, they three times override it, it just seems a bit naive.
Completely. So I'm a big believer in Internet 3.0, the Internet of ownership, right? And in the good sense of the term. And unfortunately, there's a dark underbelly of the Internet of ownership, which gets to the heart of the sort of incentive structure for these groups, where once they own your environment and they've got that unfettered access to the data and they take that data, you're completely right. It's now an asset that they own illegally, but it's an asset that they own, and they can monetize that asset in so many different ways that just, again, just pure business incentives and profit incentives alone are going to drive that activity, independent of whether or not you pay the ransom, at least for a material percentage of the time.
You know, you mentioned optics, but it is my feeling that the reason people pay is because to mitigate lawsuit risks, right? So even if this data is then exposed after they pay, I mean, that is something they can go to court and say, well, look, we tried, we took all reasonable steps. But I sort of worry that that in itself is a bit of a funny incentive when you've got a legal system that's kind of encouraging people to give money to criminals to avoid legal exposure. That sort of seems less than ideal. Do you think there's a role for regulators to step in and maybe, you know, and governments to step in and maybe issue some guidance here, or, you know, whether there should be some sort of limited indemnity? But then you skew the thing the other way, and then nobody pays, and, you know, nobody is even careful securing their environment, and then you've got different problems.
Exactly.
Right? It's like squeezing the balloon.
Right. I tell you, as a system, no, this is a super interest. This is a whole other discussion, really, because as a system, you're exactly right. If you perturb the equilibrium such as it is today in one way or the other with the indemnity and sort of loosening some of the restrictions there, or making it less binding, man, you might see an over-rotation in the other direction.
Yeah.
And so I'm not proposing we have any kind of balance right now. It feels incredibly skewed to the negative. But boy, you know, I do think that there are some sort of structural there's some structural changes that could be made, or at least worth exploring. And there's a lot of technical changes that I think this is going to drive in the long term, frankly.
Technical changes. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So a lot of, and this is something that I'm thinking about, and it's sort of, a friend of mine and I have been talking about it a lot internally. And, you know, a lot of these systems are really representing sort of these hotspots of centralized data, either where a hotspot might be an individual set of assets or a part of the ecosystem at large in an enterprise, for example, right? You've got this sort of hotspot of high quality information, high value information that they're incented to grab. Well, I think that this is going to force more decentralized storage, for example, more decentralized service architectures. I think containers are going to continue. I'm not going to propose that containers solve all of the security challenges of the world, but I think the ethos, the idea behind like service-oriented architectures in the container world, where you've got things that are very, very tightly scoped to one task and they orchestrate with one another, you get this this distributed risk surface in many cases, at least as it relates to, you know, imagine you've got, you know, n number of users that all have shards of that storage that are hashed on their local drives with using some of these sort of the new cryptocurrency driven application stacks, where you've got storage that lives out there on the blockchain. That seems to be a harder problem. It's so decentralized now, the data itself is so decentralized, it seems to be a harder problem for the adversaries to actually get that data and harvest it in a meaningful way. And so I do think that we're going to start to see the actual services themselves in the enterprise start to decouple and get more tightly scoped as they, you know, if you consider like a domain controller, for example, that thing is doing a lot of stuff on the wire. It's using LDAP, Kerberos, network, like SIFs, right? It's exposing network shares, lots and lots of things that are happening there. And all of those things, any one of them, the most recent one, right? The print service, right? They can be exploited. And when you exploit one of them, you are now privy to the subsystems and the other processes running on that host. Well, if you start to compartmentalize those things architecturally, I think the landscape could change quite a bit.
But I mean, you know, as much as we can sort of decentralize things and whatever, if you've still got central orchestration or central access, which you kind of need, right, to a degree, then, I mean, there is still some risk there. But I see what you're saying, that architectures might change to become a little bit resilient instead of everything just being, you know, on one domain that got stood up 10 years ago.
That's right. And it might, and your point stands, Patrick, 100%. It might introduce a whole other sort of problem space. But I do think that this one is one we're likely to be able to design ourselves around, frankly.
Well, I mean, it is 2021, right? And we're still talking about data that was mostly, I'm guessing, obtained from more or less flat networks, right? Which, I mean, I don't know that we need to move to like fancy pants blockchain storage to improve on the current status quo, right?
Exactly right. No, there are incremental steps and there's object level permissions and things like that. I really think that this is going to be, especially in the modern era, the last several years have been particularly heinous, frankly.
Yeah, they have.
And I think it's going to force a lot of change.
Well, I mentioned in a recent interview that ransomware has just really changed the game, in the sense that previously people did skate by on crappy security because their biggest risk might have been a data breach, which, as time showed us, wasn't really an existential threat. I mean, indeed, right now, EA, the games maker, I mean, they've been going through a shakedown. Someone's claimed to have got their source code. They have their source code, 750 gig of data, and they're trying to shake down EA. For its part, EA is saying, well, there's no gamer data in there. There's no PII, so whatever. You wonder where all this is sort of going. I do feel like, yeah, ransomware crews might be shooting themselves in the foot by being, you know, by
yes,
slipping on that customer service. Now I want to talk to you about cryptocurrencies, because that's another thing that you were keen to weigh in on. We know that the EU and US Treasury are introducing pretty serious regulatory regimes, you know, AML and KYC controls on Bitcoin specifically, that could really make a ding on some of this. But I worry about the privacy coins, right? Because you can't really do AML and KYC properly on some of these privacy coins like Monero. So where do you think that's going? Because I kind of feel like at some point, if the entire ransomware ecosystem shifted over to using privacy coins that are essentially untraceable, right, and the regulations around that start failing, I can see privacy coins actually being banned as an instrument from jurisdictions like, you know, the EU, the United States, Australia, things like that. I can definitely see that, but I wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, Bruce Schneier has a really good write-up on exactly this or related things, and he proposed, you're exactly right. I think the sort of blunt force object is just outright bans on things, right? Or at least trying their level.
I mean, you can kind of regulate Bitcoin to a degree, right? You can, but yep, you cannot regulate privacy coins. I guess that's right.
Yeah. That's right. Exactly right. And so the way you would have to maybe go after that is to target the exchanges, you know, because one of the interesting things, it's a very sort of unidirectional payment system where, you know, I pay, if you ransom my stuff, I pay into, I spend a bunch of USD, say, and I convert it into a cryptocurrency. And then someone on the other side, through an exchange, or presumably, at least in many cases, is going to pull it out the other side. In cases where that model, where you can actually grab it at the exchange level, you might have some hope. But you're right. I think ultimately,
but as soon as, like, say I buy some privacy coins on an exchange, then I send them to an address, they're gone. And when they pop up when they pop up at some other exchange, you don't know where they came from. So it's impossible to sort of place any sort of regulation there that would stop that from happening, right? So I don't see how you could really fix this by getting the exchanges to cooperate, because they don't have any insight into where money comes from either.
Yeah, I don't think that you could fix it at all. Yeah, I think it's ultimately, I'm agreeing with you. I think where they are likely to ban them first is at the exchange.
Okay. I'm with you now. Okay. Because I thought you were saying like there could be some sort of visibility at the exchanges or whatever, but you're just saying no.
Yeah, you just slapped it.
Okay, yeah. We are as one. We are like two horses pulling the carriage. Matt Cawthorn, thank you so much for joining us on Risky Biz to share some thoughts about that. I guess, you know, this is a bit of a navel-gazing interview, but it's a bit of a let's see what happens. But it is exciting, isn't it, when you don't quite know where things are going to go. But yes, Matt Cawthorn, thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to be here again.
That was Matt Cawthorn of Extra Hop Networks there. Big thanks to him for that, and huge thanks to Extra Hop Networks for being a Risky Business sponsor. And we actually had a chat after the interview. You would have heard Matt sort of refer to some blockchain-y sort of stuff there, and he is a bit of a crypto aficionado. So I asked him some more about these distributed app platforms that he kind of alluded to, and he mentioned a couple that are actually kind of interesting. There's one called Stackcoin and one called Cardano, and you know, you can see like a full re-implementation of stuff like Google Workplace based on blockchain tech. Now, I have no idea if this is a concept that's going to float commercially or be the done thing in the future, but it's conceptually at least very interesting. So do Google around and read about that if you're interested, because I found it interesting, right? But that is it for this week's show. Assuming our lockdown ends on time, I'll be off next week and you'll hear my interview with HD Moore on Rumble instead of a weekly show. So wish me luck and let's hope no more rat lickers turn up. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.